On today's programme, restrictions set to be eased as vaccine supplies increase. But is the HSE on track to vaccinate 1 million a month? We talk to the IMO's Dr. Dennis McCauley. We'll have reaction to that decision to add the US and EU countries to our mandatory hotel quarantine list. On the 23rd anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, can calm be restored to the streets of Belfast? And just how big a threat is President Biden's global tax plan to Ireland's economic future? All that and more coming up after the news with Ray Kennedy. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Martin Hayden, Minister of State with Special Responsibility for Research and Development, Farm Safety and New Market Development. Éan O'Riordan, Labour Party Spokesperson on Education, Enterprise and Trade. And Máire Farrell, Sinn Féin, Spokesperson on Public Expenditure and Reform. You can text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie or tweet to at saturdayrte. Now, as you heard there in the bulletin, 16 countries will be added to our ever-growing mandatory hotel quarantine list next week. And this, of course, follows a row last week between the Department of Health and the Department of Foreign Affairs over which countries should be included. At the end of March, the Expert Travel Advisory Group had recommended government add 43 countries to the list. But Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney argued hotel quarantine restrictions shouldn't be applied to countries where large numbers of people live. So, Martin Hayden, this is a major climb down for Simon Coveney. What changed his mind?
Well, look, you know, the media obviously will focus on the personalities of different ministers having different views, but this happens all the time in government. A Minister for Foreign Affairs will have their responsibility to the areas under their brief, as a Minister for Health will have on their side. And really, you know, my understanding of it, and while I don't say the Cabinet, is that, you know, concerns were raised last week regarding the consultation among different departments, and that is something that was clearly set down in the legislation around mandatory quarantining, that there would be detailed negotiations. Obviously, that has happened in the last week among seven different departments. This impacts on justice and defence and transport as much as health or other areas. And that consultation and planning has gone into place now to make sure.
So everything is grand. Because last Sunday I was listening to Leo Varadkar on The Week in Politics. He was talking about practical, political, legal issues around adding EU countries in particular to the list, saying we don't know if has the Department of Health enough hotels to accommodate all these people flying in from Europe. Do we know that now?
That's the level of work that's been taking place in the last week, and this is logistically a huge challenge. We shouldn't for 1 minute underestimate that the difference between adding France to the list compared to Tanzania. Like, there's a very real difference there. We have a lot of Irish people, students and otherwise, who live in France and that, but at the same time, you know, those plans have been put in place in the last week, and what we're doing here is a clear focus on countries that have variants of concern.
Martin, legal issues around EU citizens' right to travel within Europe. Are we okay about that now?
Cabinet has made a decision last night to go to from next Thursday to add those countries, and that is something that obviously the Attorney General would have a role in as well. So those legal challenges and all of those concerns have been worked through over the course of the last week, is my understanding.
Máire Farrell.
Yes, of course. I mean, it is welcome that additional countries have been added to this mandatory quarantine, hotel quarantine list. We are of the belief that all non-essential travel should be included in this. And really, I mean, we are having mixed messaging and confusion once again from government. And all these issues should have been teased out last May when this was initially brought by NPHET to government. This should have been implemented at that moment in time. I mean, really, in truth, truthfully, this is the Northern Italy flights issue that we had in last March, and it seems that nothing has been learned from that. But absolutely, we need to have this mandatory hotel quarantine. We've seen in the last week that we've seen the 10 cases came out of the 419 people that were was detected from those 419 people that have been in quarantine so far. So, I mean, it's very clearly something that needs to be done, but it does need to include all non-essential travel.
Éan O'Riordan, Labour are also on that page now.
Well, we are. And to be honest, I mean, if this had been done last May, as when NPHET recommended it should be done, we'd be in a very different situation now. All these teething problems would have been worked out and we'd have a much more effective system. But government didn't listen to NPHET last May, and we are where we are. And when it did come in terms of the 20 country list that was first produced by government, I remember saying that this would inevitably be expanded upon. I was told that it wouldn't, but then it went to 33, and now we're looking at 59. And I believe it's the inevitable that we'll have a situation where every single country will be on this list. And I wish government would just get to that point, because we only need to do this for a very defined period of time. The vaccination schedule is obviously what we want to spend most of our time concentrating on. But I have no difficulty with ministers changing their mind. I have no difficulty with that at all. There's no point in politics criticising government for not doing what you want them to do, and then when they do it, to criticise it. I wish the minister who's on the show this afternoon, and indeed all government ministers, would realise that we can protect our country much more effectively if we do what is, you know, in certain circumstances for many people, an unpopular move, but to have a blanket hotel quarantine scenario for every traveller into Ireland, and then we can actually protect our people more, because more people have died this year from COVID than in the entirety of last year.
Okay, we've just got an email in here. Katie, why isn't India on the list of countries as COVID-19 is very bad there? That's from Angela. And actually, just looking at the list now and the countries that have been added to that list, Martin Hayden, there's some, I mean, we understood that the criteria for adding countries to this list was countries with very high incidence, or countries where there was concerns about variants of concern circulating. But like, the high incidence is set at over 500 per 100,000. There's several countries that are not on the list that have those kind of numbers, such as Hungary, 1117, Poland, 989 case incidence per 100,000. Sweden, 739 cases per 100,000. And we know the community transmission of the P1 variant that we're all very worried about has been confirmed in Sweden. It just seems incredibly arbitrary how this list is being put together.
So the focus here is variants of concern.
But it is also, we have been told that it is variants of concern and countries with a very high 14-day incidence.
Yes, but in particular, variants of concern is what the legislation that we passed in the Dáil was the focus of. And the countries that are on these lists have these variants of concern, which are a very significant challenge and concern to us. But also we need to bear in mind that anybody entering this country, first of all, non-essential travel is prohibited, and you're only supposed to be travelling for essential purposes. And in that space, you're supposed to have and you need to have had a PCR test, a negative PCR test within 72 hours before travelling. So those safeguards are in place. We have one of the strictest border regimes now in all of Europe, and we are taking the decision based on the best medical advice in terms of those countries.
Are we saying the list is now just about variants, or the list is about variants and sometimes about incidents as well?
Well, obviously, like, incidence is, and we will continue to review on a regular basis, but incidence is about the direction of travel as well, because you could have a high incidence, but if the direction of travel is on a downward trajectory, then that is very different.
But if you look at Poland, say, we know that there is a lot of travel between Ireland and Poland because we have a huge number of Polish people living in this country, some people, Irish people living in Poland. 989 per 100,000. That is a very high incidence of COVID-19.
Again, to put into context here, what we were talking about, there's a 94% drop in the level of travel, you know, into Ireland now than there was before. So we're not talking about...
But Poland is one of the countries that we still see a significant level of travel. And we know that there was something like 14,000 people arrived in this country last week in all.
Yeah, and from the point of view of the decisions cabinet make, I believe they make them on the advice to the countries of the most concern. I don't sit at cabinet. I wasn't part of that meeting yesterday.
But you are here representing the government.
No, I am, and my understanding is that variants of concern is the main motivation factor behind the quarantine system, because it is the variants that are the risk for us there.
Yeah, Maureen Farrell, what's your understanding of how this list is being put together?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, and we can't seem to get a proper, a coherent answer from government in relation to this. But, I think people across the opposition, and I've just heard what Aegon said as well, have been very clear that there should be this kind of mandatory hotel quarantine across the board for all non-essential travel. And we know that what has been going on up to now hasn't been working. We've seen new variants come in. We've seen that there hasn't been adequate checking of those that were supposed to be quarantining from home. And we're now in a situation where we have people who are in long-term unemployment, who have been unemployed for over a year. We've have had the longest lockdown in Europe. We have so many businesses saying that they won't be able to reopen post-lockdown. So we need to do, and the government needs to do everything in its power to control this virus. NPHET have been asking for this and have been calling for this since last May. We should have had the teething issues sorted last May, and we should now be in a completely different situation than we are. We are in it now, and we need to include all countries, all non-essential travel to that mandatory hotel
quarantine. But then you see, I mean, and we know that, that polls have shown, and there was certainly a lot of public support for mandatory hotel quarantine in recent months, particularly when we saw what happened after Christmas. But then you get, I have a text in here, what about if we need to travel for business? I travel for work and I can't do my job. Europe must be opened, or at the very least, the list must be reviewed frequently.
But the list is reviewed frequently. So we see states like Israel haven't been taken off the list that was on it, and we will continue to do that. But, you know, the system here is very much based
on...
If I might, and I appreciate that texter's, you know, frustration. But look, all of us have been within our 5K since Christmas. Children are only getting back to school on Monday after being out. You know, some children, I should say, in secondary schools, our full school system is only back for the first time since Christmas next week. We have more, as I said, more deaths this year than last year. This thing has been ripping through the country since Christmas, and it's affecting everybody. So it's very difficult to make the argument that while we're all within our 5K, and while business has shut down, and while we can't hug our family members, and we can't meet up with people that we love, and all these things are worth it so that people don't get sick and don't die, however, we can still be reluctant to stick a few more countries onto this list. It just doesn't add up. And while, yes, it's unfortunate that people are going to, you know, lose connection with abroad or not be able to do their business and all the rest, but lots of people have been locked out of doing their business. So this is something that we just have to do, even though it may be unpopular, is to have a blanket international understanding that everybody's going to have to go through hotel quarantine while we get this thing under control. Because I understand reluctance and all the rest of it, but we're all being imprisoned, and we have been imprisoned for quite a while. So let's just find a balance here. As Mairead has quite rightly said, you know, opposition want to work with government. All of us are united against this virus. The virus is the enemy, but we have to be realistic as to how we can actually tackle it. And if we're serious about it, then we have to be, you know, have a much more blanket approach to international travel.
Regina Doherty tweeted last night, Regina Doherty, who's now, of course, the leader of the Shannon for Fine Gael. As Cabinet add more countries to mandatory hotel quarantine list this evening, questions must be asked. Until when? What are we working towards? What is our exit strategy? What is our exit strategy, Martin Hayden?
So, first of all, to say, you know, we would hope mandatory hotel quarantine lasts for as short a period of time as possible. This is not natural to us in Ireland. This is not Ireland the kid made of Fáilte.
I have to say, there is such a strong sense that the Fine Gael members of Cabinet and people like Regina Doherty, who have been very popular, have been dragged kicking and screaming to the point we're at now in terms of mandatory hotel quarantine.
Because it's a very big deal to do, and there is no doubt about that, and it's not in our nature. But, you know, vaccinations is the way out of this, and keeping a very close eye on other countries. Obviously, the trajectory in certain parts of Europe is poor in terms of case number, but it is especially around the areas of variants of concern that is the driving force behind these decisions, and the vaccinations then program, as well as regularly keeping an eye on how other countries are progressing. So countries like Albania and Israel that have been removed off the list this time, that will continue to be reviewed, and where other countries are improving. We're also looking and dealing closely with our European partners to look at the area of people with vaccinations and get an agreed international system of recognising vaccination, that people have a way of demonstrating that hopefully that
can
come into the mix.
How long could
we
be in this situation where we are now going to have very limited, for many places, very limited access to this country?
Well, that is the question. Like, you know, that in terms of the concern about going into mandatory hotel quarantining as a country, that is always a concern. So you have to look at getting our people vaccinated as quickly as possible, and we'll discuss later today here on this programme about the ramping up of our vaccination programme, but also of an improvement in the situation.
But are we talking weeks, months? Could we be in this situation this time next year?
You would very much hope not, and definitely wouldn't be good for the country if not. But as long as there are variants of concern there, we have to protect our people, and that's what we're doing.
Okay, I want to bring in Dr. Dennis McCauley now. Dr. Dennis McCauley, of course, Donegal GP and head of the Irish Medical Organisation's GP Committee. Many thanks for joining us, Dennis.
Hello, Katie. Good morning.
Just before, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the situation on the ground as we go into next week now, Dennis. But just before we leave that issue of mandatory hotel quarantine, do you have a view on the latest developments there?
I think people, it's like all the whole rollout of the planning of this. If people see equity and sort of logic to it, they're actually happy. And I think that any system that we have has to be seen to be logical. So I think there is a certain amount of logic behind the actual decisions that are being made. So yeah, I think it is logical that that if you have a quarantine system, that you try and stop people coming from very infected areas or areas where they have a high amount of variant. And if you're going to do it, do it.
And should it be blanket, as we, our opposition have been calling
really,
for
here? Katie, from that point of view, I would always I would never be a commentator on government policy. But as I say, more on a general point of view, I think if you are doing it and try and do it in as logical a way possible, and I think the decisions today were very logical.
Okay. Getting back to the situation on the ground, Dr. McCauley, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ronan Glenn, was warning this weekend that if you were exposed, if you took a chance maybe over the Easter weekend and you were exposed to the virus, you will be at your most infectious now. And he's appealing for people to contact GPs and arrange a test. Have you noticed any uptick in the last couple of days?
No, I was in the surgery this morning, and thankfully I've only had to refer one person for further testing. And thankfully the practice next door have been vaccinating all morning. So that's the sort of visual metric, the visual that I like, small amount of suspicious cases and a large amount of vaccination.
Yeah, and we're reporting today as well that 1,100 GP practices are preparing to take part in the vaccination of the medically vulnerable cohort from this weekend. Are you at that stage? Are you going to be taking part in that?
We have decided as a practice to give vaccines to the medically vulnerable. Remember, the very high risk people. There are a number of them who attend the hospital, which is fine, but quite a lot, I would say, even the actual majority of them attend only their GP. So we can identify, and it seems logical that we will vaccinate them. So thankfully, the vast majority of general practitioners have decided to actually do this, and I think that it is to be applauded, and we have to wait to see what the further planning will actually be in relation to this, following on from the decision that NIAC have to make.
Yes, and we'll get to that NIAC decision. But are you at the stage of doing that cohort now,
There will be some practices who have actually kept delivery of the AstraZeneca vaccine next week. But we have asked in our communication to our members just to not actually initiate any vaccination till we see what the actual overall decision of NIAC is.
Yeah, and just to remind people, I suppose NIAC were meeting, I think, today and met yesterday to consider the latest developments in relation to the findings around by the EMA in relation to the AstraZeneca vaccine and those cases of blood clotting. And of course, we had one case confirmed in Ireland this week as well. Have you had patients express reservations about taking the AstraZeneca vaccine in relation to this now?
I think it's only natural. There's been so much, you know, previously, I think you and I chatted about this before, AstraZeneca, there's been a lot of discussion about it. So when there's a lot of discussion about it, patients will naturally ask your advice about it. The people that we've been vaccinating so far have been the people in the over 70 cohort, and they've been getting the mRNA vaccine. So I would imagine there will be a certain amount of information giving when we are planning to give AstraZeneca, we will be giving information to each of the patient cohorts about the relative risks of this. But naturally, people are talking about it. Vaccinations is discussed more than the weather these days. So naturally, AstraZeneca will be one of the topics discussed.
Would you be worried, though, that if there is, and I mean, I'm looking at a list here of, you know, what's happening around Europe in relation to AstraZeneca now. We see, you know, some countries under 55s are no longer getting it. Other countries, we know the UK, say over 30s only. Greece has the same restriction.
Would you be worried that if further advice restricting the use of it were issued by NIAC next week, that it would again put more doubts in people's minds about whether or not they want this one at all?
I think it's only natural. I think we have to wait and see. I think there's, as you say, the options available in Germany, the vast AstraZeneca now is under 60, and in the UK it's under 30. I think regardless of what NIAC said, the actual discussion about the relative safety of all the vaccines is there. So I think it'll add to the actual commentary. Hopefully, we're expecting a very practical, straightforward recommendation from NIAC. And in a way, you would hope it will reassure rather than actually increase the sort of confusion. But we wait. We always seem to be planning a week in advance rather than weeks now. And we had plans for vaccination. We discussed it with the HHSC over the last weekend particularly, and we're ready to go with a plan. We will recalibrate that plan following on from the discussion of the recommendation of NIAC and what the government decides to do following on from that. But we will react, and if we need be, we will inform. I think that's probably the most sensible thing.
The HSE says it's aiming for between 180,000 and 190,000 vaccinations this week. Would you be confident that we will reach that target?
I think so, yes, I do. I think that the over 70s is working very well in general practice. General practice is probably contributing to half the numbers of vaccines being given every week now, and there's vaccinations being given, as I say, in my local town today, but also in the hubs in Galway and in Cork.
Because we were obviously hearing a lot of problems with supplies not arriving when they were supposed to, and people being lined up for their vaccine and not getting them. Have we streamlined all of that now?
Yes, definitely. But naturally, the world is not a perfect place when there's the 13. I think that the biggest issue that general practice had was that we weren't getting good notice of when we were getting vaccines and the amount of vaccines that we're actually getting. And that then allowed the GP to inform patients, and then we knew how many we were getting, so that the risk of us actually disappointing patients was always high when the actual communication was poor. That has improved greatly now, and it really has. And I think that there are naturally, if there's 1,300 deliveries being made in a 3-week period, there will always possibly be one unacceptable delivery error. But most of the time, the word coming back from general practitioners is that they're very content with the actual communication. And there has been a relative reduction in the Pfizer supply in the last week or so, and we were warned about that. We have been informed about that, and therefore we have reacted, and we haven't had to disappoint patients, which is primarily the main thing.
And finally, Dennis McCauley, we know the schools are fully open from Monday, so that's another 250,000 students who wouldn't have been in school since December getting back into the classroom. And again, another 20,000 or so construction workers who are building houses will be back on site from next week. Are you nervous at all about what this, you know, big movement of people might do to our case numbers?
Well, really, the first of all, I'm so happy that the schools are actually starting. There's a cohort of children that really have been discommoded greatly, and we don't want them left behind educationally. I think all of our efforts have been made directly. The economic issue of the construction is important, but I'm very focused on the Irish people have worked really hard to get the numbers down. There's a bit of a vaccination benefit perhaps coming more in the hospital numbers, but the Irish people have worked very hard. And one of the primary reasons we've worked is to get our children back to school. So yes, I applaud the fact that the children can now go back to school. I would ask everybody that now that we have started this to just to be very careful now for the next couple of weeks, particularly so we can just isolate to see. I would expect that school return will be a great success. And I would like everybody to look after, to just keep doing as they're doing, because they're doing a wonderful job, so that we can show that school is a great success. Then the vaccines will start coming in more, and we can then see, hopefully get more positive waves. I think there's a positivity this last 3 or 4 days, which is excellent. And I would like that to continue, but it can only continue with the good work that everybody is doing, if we just continue doing it.
Okay. Thank you for that, Dr. Dennis McCauley up there in Donegal. Martin Hayden, the AstraZeneca issue, is there a lot of nervousness around government now in relation to the impact that might have on our rollout?
No, there's a confidence in the systems we have and the safeguards we have and all of the public health advice that we have from NIAC and the HSE and NPHET, is that, you know, our present system is good. Obviously, it's continuously monitored, particularly by the National Immunisation Advisory Committee. And if they change their advice, then we'll change according to that. In relation to AstraZeneca,
it's... But is that not inevitable? Because we were relying on, we bought a lot of AstraZeneca. We're relying on it for a lot of our rollout.
Yeah, but if you look at what's planned for this quarter two of this year, which is April, May and June, the million vaccines a month, AstraZeneca is about 20% of that. So we are very lucky that we are in a space where we are able to draw on 4 different vaccines. And if any concern is raised by vaccines, then we will take the right decisions by the public health advice and safeguard our people. But at present, the advice very much is that the risk of COVID far outweighs any other risks, and that we are right to continue with that. If that advice changes from NIAC, then we'll change accordingly. But I just want to acknowledge as well the role of the group that Dennis represents, the 3,000 GPs and all of our staff in the vaccination centres and in the hospitals, who are doing a remarkable job and have delivered 1 million vaccines already. And, you know, the increase in scale, where we're going to see 180,000 to 190,000 people vaccinated next week, really does show the system is ramping up in a big way.
Yeah, well, I mean, the proof will be in the pudding of that. Mairead Farrell, are you confident that we have all the ducks in a row to get up to that level of vaccination?
Well, I suppose we've heard the term ramping up over the last number of months repeatedly, and I sincerely hope that this time it will be the case. I think we need to make sure that the government are very clear that they have a plan and that they have the vaccinators, that they have the equipment to deal with this ramping up that we're supposed to be getting. I mean, I think we all want to see these vaccines. I think everyone's on the same page in relation to this. We all want to see the vaccines going in into our arms, and personally I can't wait to get the vaccine. I'm 31, so I'm probably quite low down the list.
You have a bit of a wait there, Murray.
Unfortunately, but the thing is, I suppose, in relation to AstraZeneca and the questions out there, I think one thing that our experts have done fantastically over the last year has been to relay information to the general public. And I mean, we are all adults. We're talking about people over 18 who are going to get this vaccination. What is key here is that we continue that the experts continue to give that information to the public and answer any questions that they may have.
Yeah, Aon, before we leave this, it's all, I mean, listening to Dr. Dennis McCauley there, it's pretty positive. Has the tide turned to some degree here?
Oh, I hope so. And, you know, obviously there's going to be more bumps in the road. We do have issues with vaccinators and some of the paperwork that they have to supply, which was, illustrated last week. But, you know, we really want to see this in the rearview mirror in a few months' time as having been a success, because I can tell you, when somebody in your family, an elderly person in your family, does get vaccinated, the sense of release and relief that happens is quite huge. There's a massive amount of anxiety within the country. It's been built up over the course of a year. This will be a fantastic success story if it happens, as we hope it will happen. So I'm quite, you know, positive about Dennis's positivity, and we all want to see this work, and we want to see it work well.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of the reaction we're getting on here. Somebody's one texter, Dave, saying the doubts are already there. AstraZeneca is tarnished. And then I have an email from Mary saying, Katie, I'm on chemo and was given AstraZeneca, as are all category 4. But we know Pfizer is more proactive to variants. So why keep giving us AstraZeneca, as very vulnerable even to moderate disease? So there are questions, and again, and we get it every week when we mention vaccine. I'm 73. I was to get my vaccine this morning from my GP. It was cancelled because they only got 60 and they were supposed to get 150. Joke, says that texter. Just before we leave this, Aon, the schools issue and the teachers, they'd be pretty grumpy teachers going back to those classrooms on Monday after that, you know, with the row and the rancour ringing in their ears about in relation to the prioritisation list.
Well, I think they're justified. And I have to say, that there's two things I want to say about
this. I don't detect a huge amount of sympathy for them in the general public.
I have sympathy for them. And there's two things I want to say very quickly. Children are going back now next Monday, you know, for the first time since Christmas. It's important for government to realise the damage that's been done, understandably, from government point of view, as to why schools were closed and the phase reopening. You know, nobody has an issue with that. But we have called for a catch-up fund for young people, as has happened in the UK. There's £1 billion fund in the UK to recognise the damage that was done for the lack of in-school learning. If it was a road, I'm quite sure the government would throw £100 million at it. When it's children, there's always a much more reluctance. The minister is talking about summer programmes that's going to fill the gap. It's not going to work, particularly for disadvantaged young people. So I really want the government to listen to the fact that they have to analyse the damage that was done and they have to invest in it, because, yes, we do have the highest class sizes in Europe. On the teachers and the SNAs, honestly, Katie, I'm a 44-year-old guy who can do his work pretty much by himself without contact with anybody. If you're a 44-year-old SNA, that's impossible, because the nature of the job, the intimate nature of the job. Now, I think what the minister should have done was to say, right, I will meet with the education partners, I'll discuss the NIAC recommendation, I'll listen
but
to your
concerns.
But should
she have ignored the NIAC recommendation? Because no, that is the logical
schedule. No, if you look at the schedule, what has been laid out by government, which happened overnight, by the way, with no consultation. On Schedule 9, there's a list of age cohorts. And in tandem with that, there is a recommendation that those working in overcrowded settings would also be vaccinated. Now, teachers are not asking, and SNAs are not asking, to be done or to be vaccinated ahead of those who are vulnerable or ahead of those who are in elderly age groups. What they are asking is that they could be considered in tandem with these younger age groups. Now, if the minister was to sit down and say, look, I appreciate that that where you're coming from, we can work together to try and find a solution. What actually happened, though, Katie, was that we had a speech at the party conferences, at the teacher and SNA conferences, which was basically tough. Then we had, petitions for potential industrial action. And the minister could really have taken a huge amount of heat out of this by listening to concerns and having a much more nuanced view of how that schedule could be
done.
If I'm a guard, I'm a teacher, I'm a retail worker, I'm in constant contact with people, I think I have a serious case to make as to how
we're gonna have
I could
to,
be vaccinated.
We leave that. I'll just give you one last word on that, Martin Hayden. You handled it really, really badly.
Look, the move to an age-based model supports the vaccination programme objectives of protecting those at highest risk of serious illness, hospitalisation and death first regardless.
I think most people understand the logic of that now, but we're talking about how it was handled politically.
This is not easy for us to be doing as politicians. And if Aon was in government, it wouldn't be easy for him either. The fact of the matter is that, you know, we have to go on to public health advice on this one. And I absolutely understand the upset of teachers and Gardaí, essential retail workers, bus drivers, taxi drivers and soldiers and all the rest. But we have to follow the public health advice here, which is about, the mortality and morbidity rates here. Okay. And when you are older, you're at much higher risk.
OK, and there we must take a break.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. My panel today, Martin Hayden, Minister of State, Aon O'Riordan of the Labour Party, and Sinn Féin's Mairead Farrell. Now, take a listen to this.
Attention, attention. This is a police message. The crowd should disperse immediately, as force is about to be used against violent individuals. If you do not stop, impact rounds will be fired.
Now, that's from Thursday night in Belfast. And again, last night, there were more disturbances in the Tiger Bay area. Alison Morris is crime correspondent with the Belfast Telegraph, and she joins us now. Alison, can you tell us what happened last night?
Last night, there was actually sectarian clashes between gangs of youth at the North Queen Street interface. That would be quite an infamous sort of interface that joins the Republican New Lodge area with the Loyalist Tigers Bay area. In the past, that's been probably one of the most volatile flashpoints in Belfast, but in recent years, it's managed to be fairly peaceful and there's been a lot of community work done. But last night, it took obviously a massive step backwards and there was ongoing clashes between youth. There's a car set on fire and police again, where police were once again called out to the scene.
And who is behind this, do we think, in terms of the orchestration? Because we know there was another statement from the PSNI yesterday seemed to be pulling back from earlier suggestions that there was more orchestration behind it.
The reasons behind it are fairly complex and you know, they're fairly wide-reaching given, you know, what the state of loyalism at the minute and the unrest among unionism. But, I mean, there was clearly orchestration in some of those riots. We had riots in Knocknabbey, which were being organised by the South East Antrim UDA. They're basically a sort of faction of the loyalist paramilitary group that's more or less a criminal cartel at this stage, heavily involved in drug dealing. There was a number of arrests made up there quite recently. And there was part of what was going on with the backlash to that. In other areas, there is social media accounts that have been popping up over the last week or two that are advertising these protests at interfaith flashpoints. There's a suggestion of who might be behind those, but it's clearly someone with a sinister motive trying to attract crowds of young people. Once you get crowds of young people at those interfaces, and you know, it's actually the 23rd anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement today, but yet still, we have, you know, huge peace walls, huge security gates dividing the two communities. And if you attract large crowds of youth to those, it becomes very difficult to try and control what's going on. So there is definitely some paramilitary involvement in the background. And then there's an element of this is now just spreading and turning into something that young people, I suppose we use that awful phrase, recreational rat, and young people are being attracted to these situations. They're moving from one area to another area. In West Belfast on Thursday night, residents literally held each other's hands and formed a human shield across the front of the peace line to prevent young people coming near to start a riot. And so they simply moved location last night then to a different interface. To go into the sort of complexities of that, but you know, there's poverty, there's mental health problems, drug abuse, high rates of suicide among young men. I mean, there's complex social reasons why many of those housing estates are still subject to this kind of activity.
I'm not hearing the Northern Ireland Protocol or the Bobby Storey funeral in that list of reasons behind this.
We know that the protocol has been angering unionists for some time. Before lockdown started, unionists were holding and loyalists were holding a series of, I suppose, what you'd call town hall meetings, these huge Boris betrayal meetings to discuss the impact of the sea border. That's been simmering for some time and could possibly have been brought out onto the street sooner had it not been for the pandemic. And then the decision in relation to the Bobby Storey funeral, what we had there, you know, the fact, I think, that what happened was political unionism as a bloc, as in all of the political parties, called for the resignation of the chief constable. So they diverted any, you know, blame that might have existed or public anger for the fact that a large funeral had taken place during the restrictions away from the people who were at the funeral and towards the chief constable and the PSNI. And there was lots of talk of two-tier policing and, you know, the policing was favouring nationalist communities, which is all a perception. I mean, there's nothing and you know, there's no evidence to show that's a reality. And in the minds of those very young disaffected youths, people who are disengaged in many ways from society, that sort of, I think, made them believe that there was justification then for attacking the PSNI. They almost became legitimate targets. And in that case, we've had over 70 police officers have been injured in the space of a week, which is remarkable given, you know, that we've had such a period of peace and enjoyed such a period of peace in Northern Ireland at all those interfaces and even during the summer marching season. And all of a sudden, it feels like we've taken a massive jump backwards.
Okay, will you stay with us, Alison? I just want to open this out to our panel here. Mairead Farrell, I mean, it's a terrible indictment of the state of affairs in Northern Ireland that there are young people on both sides of the divide feeling so disconnected, so disenfranchised. And Sinn Féin have been in government in Northern Ireland for some time now.
Katie, I think what we've seen over the last number of weeks, and that is the whipping up of tensions. And I think Alison really hit the nail on the head that there's so much and there's a myriad of issues. But what we're seeing here now is that these illegal protests were organised by crime gangs in loyalist areas, and that must stop. But not only were these organised, these were organised crucially at interfaces. And for those people who aren't aware of what these interfaces are, I think it's really important that people understand what these are. These are peace walls between communities. Now, what is the outcome going to be of having these illegal protests at these interfaces? I mean, on Wednesday night we saw petrol bombs being thrown over at the Lanark Way
and over onto the Springfield Road. And then, yes, on Thursday night, we did see nationalist youths come out as well. Now, what is very important here, and I was only speaking to Paul Maskey, Sinn Féin's MP for West Belfast this morning in relation to that, is that Sinn Féin representatives, as well as community groups, youth workers and local residents were very much out in force throughout the week, speaking to any youths that were a congregation. Yeah. And what as Alison said there, was that there was a line made at the Peace Wall, and that is crucial, and those youths were then moved on further up the Springfield Road away from that area.
That is the immediate issue in terms of leadership and
but we do dealing need
with
to
it on the ground.
Leadership.
But the point that I think Alison would make, or that anyone analysing the situation would make, is that this has fallen on very fertile ground, because there is such feelings of disenfranchisement and disconnection, and of being left behind in these loyalist communities in
absolutely.
Particular.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been a failure. And we saw that.
Sinn Féin has been in government for this length of time in Northern Ireland.
We have seen a complete lack of leadership from political unionism over the last number of weeks. I mean, in January, we saw that Arlene Foster said...
What has Sinn Féin done for these loyalist communities?
What nationalist communities have been doing is consistently engaging in cross community work, and we've seen it even with football clubs, and we've seen statements from local football clubs. We saw one from the Shankill football club, as well as one on the other side, appealing to people to not get involved, and young people not to get involved in this kind of thing. But what is absolutely key here is that we need leadership from loyalism and from unionism to call stop on this, and to stop this whipping up of tensions. I mean, we saw in the last number of weeks the LCC wrote to the British Prime Minister saying that they no longer support the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, what is going to be the outcome of that? But holding these illegal protests at interfaces is only going to cause mayhem, and then it's going to be able to be blamed on a sectarian tit for tat.
Martin Hayden.
Yeah, look, Katie, it's essential that there's calm, measured and positive leadership, and that it's exercised at every level for all the people of Northern Ireland. And when I hear the comments of Minister for Justice in Northern Ireland, Naomi Long, and the comments she made in Stormont during the week, and that resonated very much with me. You know, our government here will play its part fully in that. Minister Simon Coveney had a lengthy conversation last night with Secretary of State Brandon Lewis. There are democratic and legal means to address everyone's concern here, whether it's in relation to policing in Northern Ireland, whether it's in relation to Brexit or other matters. There is no justification for the violence.
Have we taken our eye off the ball here, though? Because I heard Bertie Ahern this week saying that there hadn't been a British-Irish intergovernmental conference in relation to these issues offered for a number of years now. I mean...
No, I don't believe so. Like, you know, the Taoiseach had a lengthy conversation with Boris Johnson on Thursday. We have the North-South Council, the Ministerial Council that has been meeting. Look, there are loads of challenges here, and Brexit definitely has added a layer of complexity to the challenges here, and we hear that in some of the comments from people in the North. But what we need is that calm space now to be able to work through these issues and to de-escalate what's here, and there's a responsibility for that on all sides for that de-escalation.
Eoghan O'Riordan.
Well, I think there's two things here. I mean, from my interactions with communities in the North, what has been said to me is that there's a generation of young people who listen to tales of the troubles, who, you know, people in their community who went through that. Maybe they spent some time in prison. They see the, you know, the murals on the walls and the songs and all the rest of it, and they feel like they missed out. And they want to have the level of respect that maybe older people in their community have because of what they have been through in the 80s and 90s. So there's that element to it. But the second element to it is, you know, what is so striking, be it a nationalist area or be it a loyalist area in terms of working class Belfast, is that they have the same social issues that they have to deal with in terms of educational disadvantage, issues with addiction, suicide was mentioned, youth unemployment, you know, literacy issues. And unfortunately, what's been handed to these young people is a flag. And these are the things you need to be energised about, is a flag. Now, you can't eat a flag. So I think if we spent an awful lot more time talking about housing, educational disadvantage, empowerment, employment, you know, all these issues that actually unite both sides, and not to be obsessed with this identity politics as much, then we might get somewhere. And also, I think we need to be careful. Look, I have as aspirations for United Ireland as much as anybody have, and it's a completely legitimate aspiration. But I think when we speak about this and speak about border polls in the south, it's very comfortable for us in the south to talk about border polls when there's a million people in the north who are very, very, you know, uneasy about that prospect. And we now have a whole generation of young people who need no very little excuse to do what they've done over the last number of days.
Okay, let me just, before we leave this,
I want to agree with Martin, and I believe Mairead as well. Calm and calm rhetoric is what's going to help in this period of time.
Just on that last point, the rhetoric around a border poll that has grown, and those ads that appeared in the American newspapers there in the run-up to St. Patrick's Day, talking about when Ireland will be free, the first time we'd have a free land. Like, is that helpful when you see where we are today?
I think very clearly, first of all, what I would definitely say and what I've just said is that I think this violence is as a result of the whipping up of tension. What I would say is, and something from what Aegon said there is, I mean, he's talking about, I would fundamentally disagree that people see murals and hear songs and want, you know, that was a very, very difficult time. And many people and many families, like my own family, have suffered greatly as a result. So, and I want to bring about, like, I mean, one thing that we really need to talk about here is the Good Friday Agreement. I mean, we did have a situation where people came together and agreed the Good Friday Agreement. Now, the whole concept of a unity referendum is within the Good Friday Agreement. It is very clear here.
It says it is for the people of Ireland alone.
By agreement between the two parts respectively and without external impediment to exercise their right of self-determination. Okay. Now, what I would say is, in terms of what Aegon said, in terms of, you know, people can't eat a flag, and in relation to identity, I mean, obviously, clearly, the Good Friday Agreement also deals with the whole issue of identity, and that it is important that people can identify as British, they can identify as Irish or whatever they wish to identify. So I think that's very important, but we cannot forget the Good Friday Agreement and how important the Good Friday Agreement is, and we cannot undermine that document.
Okay, we're going to have to leave that there. Alison Morris, many thanks for joining us with that update, and there we take a break.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, earlier this week, US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen declared her government support for a global minimum tax rate, calling time on what she described as a 30-year race to the bottom on corporate tax rates. Yellen proposed a base rate of 21% tax on US multinationals' foreign profits, no matter where that taxable income is earned. And of course, we know a lot of that taxable income is currently booked in Ireland. I'm joined now by the Chief Executive of the American Chamber of Commerce, Mark Redmond. Mark, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Katie.
Mark, just before we get to that tax proposal, very quickly, can I just get your reaction to that move to include the US and EU countries to the hotel mandatory quarantine list?
Sure, Katie. And bearing in mind, we're not health experts and we do recognise the challenge for decision makers. I guess our job is to point out the importance of Ireland's globally hard-won reputation for both inbound and outbound investment. Because, Katie, this also is relevant for the 650 Irish businesses who are operating in the States. Ireland is the ninth biggest investor in the States. So transatlantic air connectivity has been crucial to growing that two-way trade. So if, as looks likely, the US is to be included, it is so important that we get clarity quickly on the status of those fully vaccinated, clarity quickly on duration of the US on the list and the criteria for reviewing them and taking them off the list, and also recognition of the critical importance of decision makers and those who have expertise on keeping global supply chains going. So there would be our comments on that, Katie.
Okay. Well, let's move on then to that big State of the Nation address by Janet Yellen. There is a sense now, isn't there, that it's just a proposal, but that US multinationals that have enjoyed extremely generous tax regime here are running out of road?
No, I don't agree. And you rightly said that Secretary Yellen is focusing on a race to the bottom in corporation tax rates. Ireland isn't in that race. In fact, Ireland has increased its corporate tax rate since US multinationals have been coming here. And in fact, Katie, as this issue went its way through the Houses of Congress and the bipartisan give and take, the critically important strategic place Ireland plays for the United States business interests will come into sharp focus. Now, why do I say that? Because the United States has 5% of the world's population. Its economic model demands it does business with the other 95%. And the most important market for it, the European Union. And who is the most successful English-speaking common law gateway to the European Union for US business? Ireland. So actually, Ireland, I think, is very well placed, but we need to be very strategic in how we manage this process.
But it's unlikely that Joe Biden will take pity on the old sod and exclude the multinationals based here from this proposal.
Well, I'm happy to tell you, the multinationals don't need pity because, Katie, tax never turns a bad business decision into a good one. But clearly, US investment by 800 companies in Ireland have been good business decisions because they keep on taking them. So while tax is important, how we're going to keep being successful in attracting US business is about talent, innovation, infrastructure, inclusion, sustainability. So they're the key factors. And by the way, where people want to live, also hugely important. So this is an important time for Ireland, Katie, but tax is not the only criteria.
Okay, not the only criteria, but we must acknowledge an important criteria when multinationals are making decisions about when to invest, where to invest, whether to expand. So will it have an impact, do you think, in the medium to longer term on those decisions?
Well, what's significant as well about the last 2 weeks is the US are now getting behind what's called the OECD global program to reform multinationals and how they're taxed, right? And Ireland has actually supported that in preference to unilateral actions. So I think multinationals have already, if you will, priced in the fact that global reform is happening. But yet we've never seen such a strong pipeline of US investment in Ireland. So I'm not being naive. Corporate tax and personal taxes, really, really important. But it's all about talent. It's all about innovation. It's all about infrastructure. That's how we're going to win the next FDI battles in this country.
Okay, I'm afraid I just don't have time to get back to the panel because we are just right up against it time-wise. We will no doubt continue this conversation again. Mark Redman, many thanks for joining us for those few minutes. And that's it. The programme was produced today by Brian Lally. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. And Jamie Doyle was on sound. So from all of the team here, enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.